We'll continue today with our reading and commenting on the Shodaka. This is how this section begins, and this is from Yokodaishi. He says, the precious grass of the Himalayas is the only kind in the meadow. Cows that graze there give the best milk, from which is made the richest cheese. Zen students partake of teaching always as pure. So, with any Zen writing, with any Buddhist writing, you have to see what's it pointing at. And remember that there's never any kind of precious metaphors going on here. It's all about pointing to our true nature somehow. How to realize our true nature, or how this true nature manifests in our life, in a life of liberation. So here he's saying that there's only one kind of grass in the meadows of the Himalayas. What does he mean by that? It's called the precious grass. Well, you have to say, you have to look like what's being pointed at here. Is he speaking of the Himalayas as a geographical location, or is it referring to something else? Precious grass. What's precious about it? Grass is grass. Commonplace. Cows eat it. This is the only grass in the meadow. Every meadow, not just the Himalayas. And cows that partake of it give it the best milk and the richest cheese. So we're all cows, grazing on the grass. Question is it the grass of the Himalayas? Is it the grass that we know as the only grass there is? The purest grass. It's the only grass, the only kind in the meadow, he says. Hidden behind that, not too obscurely, is that every moment, we have to turn into this precious grass that is the source of our rich cheese, as it were. The most nourishing thing. In other words, we all have the karma that is exactly appropriate, exactly the best karma for us, exactly the thing that can be transformed into the most wonderful thing, the richest and fullest of our life. How do you do that? Well, this is the practice of Zazen. This is the practice which, as Dogen says, is enlightenment itself. Dogen's famous phrase, practice is enlightenment and enlightenment is practice. So how do we carry on this day to day? This dealing with whatever comes into our life as the greatest nourishment we could have. Well, if it's the only grass in the meadow, then it's the only grass there is. All comparisons are irrelevant. All judgments upon our karma of the moment are detractors from transforming this moment into a place of great richness. In other words, the mind that we are accustomed to is the great saboteur. We human beings, this is the big, broad swath of the picture of the practice of Zen, the practice of liberation. We human beings, have a made-up self that is tormented by a made-up reality, both of which are quite real. They just have no substance. They don't exist. They are real, but they do not exist. They are real in that they have an effect. Constantly people are concerned about themselves. Constantly people are concerned about this external reality that they speak of. And constantly the interaction between the two is what creates the rich, tormenting fabric of human life. Nothing wrong with that. Interesting drama, like an opera. We human beings stretch a bit. We We make up operas. We sing about everything, great tragedies, great elation, love and death, whatever it is, we sing about it. We don't make the little extra step of realizing that we do that all the time. This is not just in an opera. Now, all these things, all these arisings of a self that we call real, and all the arisings of the things in the external world that we name and that we give form to and that we give significance to, are not dreams in the sense of unreal, but they are dreams in the sense of they cannot be grasped as any distinct entity. Cushions can, grass can, cows can, floors can, doors can, hands, feet, whatever. But this cannot be grasped. This is totally elusive, just like a dream. Now, what we say in Zen is, this is the broad swath, is that we need to really realize that. Without denying it, without making it bad or good, or bothering ourselves with being tormented by this thing, and how come me, and why is my karma this way, and all that sort of stuff. This is all the arising of this wonderful rich grass, which we think is not rich grass. But every moment of it gives an opportunity to see through it, to see what this mind does. Like a picture framed on a wall in a gallery, opens our eyes to what is there. We walk outside from the gallery and we see the world in a different way. Because we, in a sense, have been trained by this picture show. The wonderful value that, one of the wonderful values that pictorial art has. And we see through the eyes of a Van Gogh, of Cézanne, of a Monet, whatever it is, we see through those eyes. We see to some little degree the world that they saw. Then we go outside, and the world can be transformed. Likewise, Zen presents this way of viewing. This is the rich grass. Everything here is the only grass in the meadow. It's precious. Precious because it has nourishment in it. And we Zen cows need to graze upon it in a way that produces this rich milk, that produces the best of all cheeses. In other words, it comes to realize our true nature. Latent. Our true nature is latent in the, we might say, cheese is latent in the milk. The milk is latent in the cow. The milk is latent, the cheese is latent in the grass that the cow eats. How do we do that? Well, we stop giving reality, conferring reality upon all these things that course through the minds. We see them as mere phenomena, which is not merely a way of seeing them. It is simply what they are. They arise out of causes and conditions, and they are indeed the manifestation of this one reality, manifesting here as grass, and here as a person, and here as a breath, and here as a cushion. Here is an interaction that we have with someone. Here as words that have been spoken, manifesting in all these many ways. And they are all the phenomenal appearances, rising, taking momentary form and transforming immediately as this great river of karma flows on. And we human beings, we grasp at them. We try to make them solid, we put boundaries around them, we define them, we give them names, we give them a history. Again, there's nothing wrong with that, that can be used. But it is not the field of nourishment. It is not the field where we find our true nature. It is not the field of liberation. Zen offers the field of liberation. It says, do this practice that you begin by thinking leads to enlightenment and ultimately becomes enlightenment itself. This practice of merely noting these things, with welcoming, with welcoming to whatever comes in because it is the opportunity to see how the mind works, to notice the process of solidifying and merely noticing it. Becoming, as we do through that process, street smart about the mind. All these things, without any effort to do it, fall away as obstructions. And as they fall away as obstructions, the substantial, existent world starts to manifest itself through the little chinks, and finally we awaken to it. And then, with our feet firmly rooted upon it, we are able to enter into this world, this made-up world, and utilize it. But no longer are we utilized by it. And then we too can say with Shakyamuni, when he is reputed to have said, I have seen you, builder of this house. No longer will you build this house around me. What is this builder of the house? A question that's not useful to ask, for it is only a metaphor. There is no builder of this house around us. It is all insubstantial. It's the great mystery of being a human being, that we make real things that have no substance. That is the deepest mystery of being a human being. We make real things that have no existence. That's the vast story of human beings on the planet that leads to great accomplishments, its sources of happiness, and great depredation upon this planet and upon other people on the planet. So this matter of coming to liberation, coming to develop a different relationship to this human being, this divided being that creates things and gives reality to things, to form a different relationship to it, is the fruit and manifestation of this liberation. And it is to that he refers. We're talking about the practice of Zen, the practice of liberation, the practice of being liberated, the practice of Buddha. But be careful, don't put these names on it as they're opposed to something else. There is no Buddha opposed to anything else. Unlike dualistic systems where there is a god and a devil and so on. Nothing is reified in the true practice of Zen. Nothing is given solidification. And then, interestingly and wonderfully, another facet of this marvel of being a human being manifests who we are with our unique bent, our unique trajectory, our unique preferences, our unique style. For we do not turn into some uniform thing. Just as oak trees don't turn into peach trees. They're all unique manifestations here, but just stop making a history and a name and a big deal out of it. Rather manifest it. Manifested in the spontaneity of the interaction with the world that is your particular style, your particular way. And don't step back and wonder, am I being spontaneous and am I doing it my unique way? This is trust. This is faith. The universe is always manifesting on its own terms. We don't know all the parameters. An ancient battle within human beings is between determining one's life and the course of one's life through planning and strategizing and reaching goals and all of that. Another one is allowing it to develop and trusting in luck and good fortune. Is one right and is one wrong? Well, they both are facets of the same thing in the way that we human beings manifest ourselves. We have a mind where we can strategize and learn and make plans and work towards certain goals. On the other hand, we are absolutely unaware of all the parameters that exist and determine any particular thing that occurs in our life. And to that degree, we can call that fate, chance, luck, or whatever. It's not a matter of one or the other. So likewise, we as human beings have to have some humor about these things. We engage in this practice of Zen. We know certain things. We have developed a certain knowledge through our learnings in Zen about not giving reality to certain things, to the things that come through the mind, treating them as junk mail. We have various skillful means. That's the strategizing part. We know to be alert. We know to be at one with whatever we're doing. We can do these things. But it would be wrong to extend that to the degree of thinking, well, I'm doing that, why isn't enlightenment coming? Because there are all other kinds of parameters that are going on under the surface. Just as with our ordinary life, all kinds of things about which we are unaware and over which we cannot, which we cannot, in a sense, control because we don't know them. So they too will enter in, and therefore we say that the moment of enlightenment cannot be predicted. And the exact circumstances that lead to this cannot be clearly defined. This is the fallacy of folks that would define steps and stages. So here we are. We are in a mystery. We can do certain things, but we must not delude ourselves that we can do everything. We must have this faith and trust that is founded upon the most marvelous, enigmatic statement that is made by Buddhism, by Zen, by the Buddha. That is, you are already Buddha. Already. On the one hand, this doesn't say more than that you are already a participant in this single reality that is this vast fabric of which you are conscious of only a tiny amount, of karma, of causes and conditions which unfolds inevitably. That is who you are. But knowing it is another thing. Understanding it is one thing. But knowing it is another. And that makes the whole difference between the knowledgeable Buddhist and the enlightened Zen person. Well, Yokodaishi goes on. He says, when human character is purified, it is the character of all beings. When the law of humanity is completed, it is the law of the universe. So, what does that mean? The character of a human being is purified. It is the character of all beings. We say that everything manifests in front of our eyes as having a bodhisattva quality. You look at the cushions, trees, birds, whatever. They have no agenda at being other than what they are. They are not at all concerned about beginning and end, birth and death, formation and destruction. They are not in any way doing comparisons between themselves and some other distinct thing. And yet they are manifesting themselves totally and fully as whatever they are, as what the karma of that particular island, being a cushion or oak tree, is manifesting. They're all around us, teaching us, saying, this is our life. What about you human beings now? So Yogadaishi says, when the human character is purified, it is the character of all beings. Purified of what? Purified of, we say, delusions, ideas, making real. What these really are is some funny tendency in our being to make solid and real things that have no substance. We are reality makers. When it is purified of the addiction to that, of conferring upon them existence instead of allowing them to simply be things that we make real for some useful purpose. And not being driven by it. This is the purification. the purification means that when this, all these tendencies are seen through for what they are and they no longer have power over us, there is only one thing in our consciousness. There is only the presence to, what shall we call it, this moment? Well, that implies that it's compared to the past moment and future moment. And as the Xinjin Ming points out, there is no past, there is no future, there is no, not even the present moment. Because these two are always in reference. So it is dropping the way of reference points. Dropping the way of reference points means that we as a distinct envisioned self disappear. And in that disappearance, as Dogen says, true self is no self. In the disappearance of that, we appear. We appear as who we are, fundamentally Buddha nature. But if we step out and look back on it and make some description and compare it, we're back, transforming it into the old game. This we must be very street smart about. We must understand this. For that understanding will save us when the tendency comes in to do exactly that with it. Therefore we trust and we abandon. This is what abandonment or surrender means. It means letting oneself be carried by this nameless thing, though the mind wants to come in and describe it. Step apart from it, put stages on it, compare it with some past time or whatever. Letting go. This is what's meant by letting go. What are we letting go of? Letting go of that tendency. Stand outside and compare, make comments on whatever. This is all a wonderful function of our mind. Great, valuable tool. But terrible, terrible master. The source of all suffering. As well, of course, as all accomplishments in human civilization. But to be able to use it and not be used by it. This is the key. It's what is meant by purifying the human character. And it becomes then the character of all beings. You join your brothers and sisters. All of trees and cushions and sky, clouds, so on. When people have a little, what do we say, an exaltation, they are looking at a passing cloud or a beautiful sunset or a meadow with the evening light upon it or whatever it is. And they feel that wonderful sense of, what do we call it, beauty, presence, whatever it is. This is a hint. This is a hint. This is an encouraging hint. Let go. Know yourself as that field. Know yourself as that cloud. Know yourself as that bird that chirps, that calls out in the night. Don't package it. Don't make it something other than you. This is recognizing the sweet grass of the Himalayas. Going on, he says, when the law of humanity is completed, it is the law of the universe. And that's saying the same thing. We human beings, humanity, we are the same as this universe. There's no separation, no distinction. What we thought was a separate law governing human beings, separate body of unique peculiarities, becomes merely a manifestation on this island called human being, called ourselves, of this one universal dharma. Not a law, but that's the way it gets translated. Law simply means the ordered structure of things. Nothing is random. Nothing is accidental. Nothing is without interrelationship with all things. Nothing is not a manifestation of this one reality. We say interimly, we say interaction among all things, we say mutual interdependence. But this is only a transitional way of thinking about it. as long as we are still thinking about things, then we say interrelationship of all things. But that is on the way to knowing that there are no things and that there is only one reality. And this is how the law of human being, the law of humanity, becomes realized, made real in one's being as the law of the universe, and the law of the universe is made real in one's being as one's own being, one's own dharma. So in that sense, the koans that speak of the mountain walking, when you walk, the mountain walks. Going on, Yoka says, one moon is reflected on many waters. Innumerable reflections are nothing but the image of one moon. One moon is reflected on many waters. Moon is a common symbol in Zen of the enlightened mind. Just as a dark night, totally dark night, we see some totally dark nights sometimes in the winter. Silent, totally silent. Any little sounds are absorbed by the snow. It's a wonderful experience in this part of the world. We can sometimes, unlike other parts of the world, other times, we can experience silence. We can experience total darkness. This total darkness and total silence is taken as a world of non-differentiation. So darkness is light here. So the process of enlightenment is, in a sense, a process of endarkenment. Endarkenment in the sense of dropping away the addiction to the distinction among all things. In darkness, the old adage says, at night all cats are gray. Dropping away the distinction among all things awakens us to, there is only one reality. So likewise, the moon is taken as a symbol of this enlightened mind. So it says, the moon is reflected on many waters. An image often used in Zen. The moon at night is reflected on the ocean, the lake, the bird bath, a little puddle, the tiniest little drop of dew on the grass, on a blade of grass. It's the same moon, but reflected in all these different circumstances. Then it's taken as an image indicating that this one Buddha mind manifests in all these different ways, but it is all a manifestation of this one thing. It may look different. If you have 100 puddles, there'll be 100 moons. That is to say, reflections of the one moon. Is there something inferior about the dewdrop's reflection? Is there something more vast about the reflection within the vast ocean? We make those distinctions, but there is only one moon, manifesting in all these ways. So this one reality manifests in your unique circumstance. A circumstance which, on the one hand, may have waves. That is to say, it may have waves of worry and anger and despair and whatever. All those things are the manifestations of this one thing. That is why it says there is only one grass, one precious grass. We make distinctions, and we think, well, I'm not really, I'm far from the Buddha mind. My mind is filled with this fear, this worry, this despair, whatever. But the big switch takes place. Where does he say later on here? Oh yes, he says, a snap of the fingers, and 8,000 gates of the teaching are established, a wink of the eye, and countless ages of time have vanished. As soon as we, applying our practice, see these things and realize, these too are manifestations of this one reality. Why do I have to oppose them? Why do I have to battle them? Why do I have to make some judgment upon them? Why do I have to take them as some kind of indication of this defective self? This self that falls short of something. And so what happens is, instead of the compartments and the walls, a vast fluidity, a vast openness, a vast spaciousness encompasses all these things. And it is a manifestation of great compassion, great kindness. For there is unkindness within the mind that opposes these things and wants to get rid of them and does battle. But there is great kindness, great compassion. The compassion, we say, of that Buddha nature that is our nature. When you transform one's attitude to these things and embrace them, it's just this. It's just one more of these phenomena. And when you can experience it in that way, it drops away as an obstruction. It drops away as a rigid boundary. It drops away as a characteristic that can bring you sadness and whatever. And yet the sadness may be there, but it is merely an experience of what it is to be a human being at this particular moment. An experience of what it is to manifest Buddha nature as sadness in this moment. It is not a big deal. That is to say, it is not something that you have to add on to as, how could I have avoided it? Or why is my life always like this? Or whatever it is. You don't have to do that. That vast spaciousness, that vast compassion, is the activity of Buddha nature itself. Thus, every moment, as we say in Zen, every moment is an occasion for awakening. If we realize that there is only one grass in this field, and this is precious grass, precious in the sense of it is all very nourishing. Not precious in the sense that there are things that are not precious. This is the living teaching of Zen. This is the activity of actual practice. So going on. It says, one moon is reflected in many waters. Innumerable reflections are nothing but the image of one moon. The Dharmakaya of all Buddhas becomes my inner being. My inner being is unified with Tathagata. And that's all we've been speaking of. We speak of inner being, outer being, so on. And many people operate in that way. It's very common, almost universal, almost universal. That there is an inner being about which people may have all kinds of opinions. That it is inferior, that it is broken, that it is a fraud, that it is whatever. And then there is an outer being that they present as a front. Which is common. Most kids grow up with something like that. Inner being that's protected, inner being that is valued, but inner being that is thought to be maybe sometimes broken or bad or whatever it is, and then the outer being that one prepares. As T.S. Eliot says, we prepare a face to meet the faces that we meet. We prepare something, we present ourselves in that way in order to survive, in order not to be rejected, in order to kind of not be thrown out in the snow. It's common. Common form of this constructed self. Yet, this inner being, when you realize, even if you think it's broken or bad or a fraud or not okay and nobody would love me or whatever it is, then you realize this is Tathagata. This is Buddha nature. All of this is Buddha nature. There is nothing outside of Buddha nature. It is all just this manifestation that I've busied my life for so long with putting names on and constructions and judgments and all that. What it is to be a human being. That kind of kindness, opens the door for a different relationship to everything that comes into your world. This is the most marvelous thing. It's a great product of ongoing Zen practice. It's a different relationship. You come into a different relationship to all these things that course through your being. Previously divided into external world, internal world, good things, bad things, and so on. Come into a different relationship than they are all the precious grass of the Himalayas. And as you do that, you turn them into rich milk, and that becomes rich cheese, as it were. So, Goyan, he says, one stage of meditation contains all other stages completely. And that's, people make up stages, and we temporarily make up stages. We temporarily, in giving instruction in the practice of Zen, will say, first, do this, second, do that, observe, name the thoughts, observe, just watch them shift from being them to observing them, and so on, and so on. We produce them, but these are all provisional. Every teaching in Zen is provisional. It is temporary. It's based upon a response to the actual situation of a given human being at a given time. This is true of the teaching of the Buddha and true of all the teachings of Zen. And it is the life of Dobson. It is the life of this individual working with the teacher. It's interacting with what is so right now. So in that sense, it contains all stages completely. Remember, the blinking of an eye. Don't try to work that out. Just walk on. Utilize skillful means appropriate to the circumstances. When the circumstances change, walk on. Settle nowhere. Hold to nothing as a conclusion or an achievement. Just walk on. Goyan, he says, the essence of mind is not limited by color, form, thought, or any activity. That is to say, it cannot be defined. We all do these temporarily. And it may be useful sometimes, but it's a great pitfall. A great pitfall, these words that produce so much exaltation and kind of high feelings among people. God is everywhere. There's only one reality. Oh, be careful. We say in Zen, a lie is more dangerous in proportion to the amount of truth it contains. These are not false. But they are pitfalls because they tempt us to think that we've gotten something. And it doesn't matter what you think you've got. Because thinking you've gotten anything is merely a symptom of the arising of someone who's gotten something into something that they've gotten. And it's a statement about the poverty-stricken being. And it is not about Buddha nature, exalted though the thought may be. That's the hidden secret of silence in Zen. Be quiet. Quiet. Quiet in this mind. Not so much be quiet in terms of how you slam a door, but it's be quiet in the mind before these kinds of distinctions and graspings. Let them all be. Let them all be. And then, you can do that in the midst of the hustle and bustle of a city as much as you can do it in the silence of a winter forest. For outer silence is but a symbol and facilitation for the arising of this more important inner silence. Goyan, he says, a snap of the fingers and 8,000 gates of the teaching are established. In other words, it doesn't take a lot of gradualness to do this. As soon as you get it, as soon as you transform your attitude, then something occurs. This is a part of the mystery of being a human being. in the world of thinking, in the world of the acquisition of accomplishments in the samsaric world. Yes, there are many stages and much work we see now in the current Olympics. You know, these folks have to practice a long time. They practice all year, and for years and years they practice in order to accomplish something. That's what we have to do for that kind of thing. But being able to be an accomplished Olympian in any given area is quite unrelated in all ways to one to the practice of Zen. For Zen is not a goal to be achieved. It's not something we don't have. It is something we already have, but the one way in which they're similar is that in the Olympian, as with the determined practitioner of Zen, there has to be a determination and a consistency and constancy of this work. And that's why it is one of the three pillars of Zen. Gradually you home in, you realize, because there's only one grass, there's only one work. Chew it up at each moment. Work with each moment. And I say work, but it's not really work, because there's no opponent. Be with it. Be street smart about it. Then, in the twinkling of an eye, as the next line goes, a wink of the eye, and countless ages of time have vanished. That is to say, the addiction to one's life as an event within time vanishes. Why? Because time vanishes. For time is but a digitized construction, analog if you wish, but it's a construction whereupon we hang things that exist within our conscious mind. The so-called past, the so-called future, so on and so on. Not useless, can be useful in a lot of contexts, but not for the context of liberation. Just as all the tools that one has acquired and can utilize well for accomplishments within the samsaric world are all good and wonderful in that domain, but here they are not useful. The very presupposition of them has to be dropped away. The presupposition of the need to get something for self all has to drop away. This is what is really radical, revolutionary about Zen. Zen places this front and center. Many other religions that contain the possibility of a spiritual path, it's deeply hidden and one has to really look for it. But Zen places it front and center. Finally, he says at the end of this particular section, innumerable names and categories have nothing to do with my realization. And that's the courageous kind of self-empowerment of Zen. All these stages and so on, they may be useful in someone, but be very careful, oh, so careful. Because they tempt one into making this like everything else. Like something out of the samsaric world. Something based upon time, something based upon itself. Look for the presuppositions. What is presupposed be underneath it all? And if there is any presupposition of duality, you know it's the wrong direction. And simply have an attitude of kindness and street smartness about it. And go, oh yes, human beings, we do that, don't we? And let it be. Walk on. What's walk on mean? It means being one with the walking on. Being one with this moment. What is it? Breath? What is it? Pain? What is it? What is it? Doesn't matter. Just this. Just this. And it is all a manifestation of this one Buddha mind. All of it. What a radical thought. All of it. All of it.